This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 8th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 399. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, Canada is hosting the G7 summit beginning June 15th in Kananaskis, Alberta, and it's co-hosting the FIFA World Cup in June and July 2026 in Vancouver and Toronto. But the world is a ball of conflict and confusion. Hot wars, cold wars, trade wars. Is World War III underway and we just don't know it? That is one of my questions for the guest this week, Professor Christian Luprecht from the Royal Military College of Canada and a senior fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Breaker.News podcast, the Big Deal on the Breaker.News podcast. And joining me this week is Christian Luprecht, Department of Political Science and Economics from Royal Military College and a senior fellow with Macdonald Laurier Institute. Professor Luprecht joins me from Brussels, where he is on sabbatical right now. And as we speak here on June the 5th, that's when we're recording it, and it's happening in real time, so things might change by the time you hear the podcast or see the podcast. Elon Musk and Donald Trump are having a very messy breakup. We saw Elon Musk end his work at the White House last week, but this week Elon Musk says he's not happy with Donald Trump's budget, his big beautiful budget or big beautiful bill, and now it's playing out in real time. Donald Trump is pulling subsidies and contracts, he says, from Elon Musk. Elon Musk is replying with some pretty nasty words, accusations of Donald Trump connections with Jeffrey Epstein. Professor Luprecht, where is this going? Where might this end?
Well, if nothing else, I always think, you know, Donald Trump has amazing political instincts, at least when it comes to appealing to his base. And I think he sensed that Musk was quickly becoming a liability, including with his base, when he started going after golden cows that and these sacred cows that are untouchable. In particular in terms of some of the social supports, because of course many of his base find themselves in particular socioeconomic challenging circumstances. And look, this is par for the course, right? So when you get in Trump's way, or he sniffs out that that your value to him has ceased, he'll throw you under the bus. And in this particular case, he doubled down because, of course, he let the EV subsidies be pulled from the congressional budget bill. And it looks like in good Trump fashion, once you get in his way and you pick a fight with him, then he'll keep on turning the thumb screws. And I think that's what we see. But look, this is historical in the U.S. You look back at the Rockefellers, you look back at sort of other super wealthy that have tried to get a little bit too close to political power. And it turns out then when you get too close to the sun, you end up getting burned. And I think this is for all those people who are so worried about the robustness of U.S. democracy. I think this is one of the key distinctions between U.S. democracy and a Putin kleptocracy, because the oligarchs and the kleptocrats are really all in it together in the Putin regime, whereas in the U.S. There is still an interesting responsiveness by the political leadership, first and foremost by Donald Trump, to the expectations, at least, of his base.
Yeah, we're talking just days after the spectacular operation by Ukraine in Russia, the Operation Spiderweb, the attack on the Russian Air Force, essentially crippling major parts of the Russian Air Force at a number of bases, destroying aviation assets with drones. And the way it was delivered was quite spectacular. The fact that this was kept secret for so long by Zelensky and his group around him. We're also seeing the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. There's lone wolf anti-Semitic terrorism in the United States. The the assassination of a couple of diplomats at Israel's embassy in Washington, D.C., and then the incident of Molotov cocktails at a peaceful protest in Boulder, Colorado. And of course, Iran is behind Hamas. And then there's just the ongoing threats that have never gone away that could intensify by China to invade Taiwan. A question, I guess, maybe from left field, maybe our listeners might think it's from left field, but are we in World War III, or are we on the cusp of World War III, or is it a case of the enemies of the West act every day like it is World War III, but the West just doesn't see it? The West might be in denial. Where are we going? What is happening?
It's a great observation, because I think a lot of people miss that. And the book to read on this is a book called Unrestricted Warfare, written by two Chinese colonels in 1999. And it lays out the entire gamut of the way countries such as Russia and China deal with us in terms of using gray zone tactics and hybrid warfare to undermine us and our instruments of state, our democratic institutions, our prosperity, our security, our social harmony. Look, China and Russia, their paradigm is that they feel they are at war with us. That is their way of dealing with us. We have this extremely antiquated view of sort of peace and war, if it were black and white. And it is causing us to make terribly ill-informed decisions, especially in this country when it comes to our national security posture or defense spending, for instance, because we essentially, most Canadians live in the world that hasn't existed for over a quarter of a century, and they desperately want to hold on to it and desperately want to refuse to deal with the realities of the world that we actually live in. And the result has been that Canada has become exceptionally vulnerable to hybrid warfare and gray zone tactics. Look at everything from money laundering to foreign interference to malign influence to the way that triads, cartels, and transnational organized crime has deliberately set up shop in this country because of all the weaknesses that we've created. So absolutely, and they've identified Canada as sort of the weak link in the ally chain. And that's, of course, where the complaints from the Biden administration, the Trump administration, Congress, and so forth come from when they talk about weaknesses in security, defense, and the like. So yeah, we desperately need a paradigm change. And I think it's becoming an increasing rude awakening, in particular from our allies and partners, because look, why are we all alone? You'd expect that when we're being threatened, our sovereignty, our economy, our economic sovereignty, our political sovereignty are threatened by a U.S. president, you would think that our allies would come and stand with us. And look, it's crickets. Why? Because we live in a terribly ignorant Canadian navel-gazing world that simply refuses to deal with the realities of how we need to engage with our world and how we need to engage with our allies and partners. And if we don't support them, no surprise that they're not going to support us. So we can only hope that when Prime Minister Carney talks about both a renewed security and trade pact with the United States, but also reinvigorating our relationship with Europe, which we've traditionally used to counterbalance the vagaries of unilateralism, that is actually serious, and these are not platitudes, because if they're platitudes, then that will be the end of Canadian sovereignty, because we'll have no option than to draw closer to the United States.
You're referring to Donald Trump's trade war, which has hung over Canada for much of 2025, and Mark Carney and the Liberal Party won the election really with a campaign of fear. His message was that Canada's economic and defense relationship with the United States has changed forever. We've got to look at perhaps new trading partners. We've got to look at a new deal with the United States. There's a report in the Globe Mail today that there have been some secret talks, behind the scenes talks between Carney and Trump beyond his visit to the White House from May 6th. We'll see where that goes. Meanwhile, domestically, Canada's first ministers met in Saskatoon, except for BC Premier David Eby, who was over in Japan at the time on a trade mission. Now, Mark Carney promised during the election free trade within Canada, by Canada Day, but at the same time, he's negotiating this new deal with Donald Trump on trade and security. Can Mark Carney pull off both?
I think that's what his future will ultimately hinge on. So you say that he ran a campaign based on fear. I actually think it's more nuanced than that. I refer to Mark Carney as our first techno-populist prime minister, because the genius of how he was able to turn around the fortunes of this flagging Liberal Party after a decade of ideology that caused the economy to flatline and left us in a terribly weak fiscal position, propped up by the steroids of public funding, is that on the one hand, this appeal to technocracy, so expertise and competence, which of course this man exudes in droves like perhaps no one else that we can think of, but also this populist appeal to the people, and in particular, I think, to that left-leaning, latent, urban anti-Americanism that other Liberal prime ministers, I think of Trudeau Senior, for instance, have tapped very successfully. And now, of course, he has to deliver. He has to deliver on the expertise and competence. Can he actually do it better than the ideology that we got for the past 10 years? Because if he can't do it any better, it will end like Paul Martin, I think, for the government. And at the same time, can he actually bring Canadians together with this sort of populist appeal? This, you know, I think he's taking a sort of Doug Ford slogan, basically, get it done, and scaling this up in terms of these huge exaggerations about, you know, the freest, the strongest country that these pluralisms can he actually deliver on what he's laying out? Because I worry that the way he brought these together as a winning coalition from centrists and people on the left, that if he doesn't deliver, it is not just going to end very badly for him and his government, reminder Paul Martin, it is also going to end really badly for this country.
Now, Mark Carney is not only the Prime Minister of Canada, but he's also the President of the G7. It's a revolving presidency that is conferred upon the host nation for the annual summit, and that annual summit of the G7 is happening in Kananaskis, Alberta, from June 15th to 17th. Donald Trump is scheduled to be there, and of course other leaders are scheduled to be there. It'll be a focus of the world when that happens that week. What do you expect the world leaders to be discussing at G7? What do you expect might be the outcome of their discussions at G7 at Kananaskis when Mark Carney chairs this meeting?
Well, you remember the last time Canada hosted a G7, and our prime minister promptly capitalized on it to seriously alienate President Trump and the Trump administration, which ultimately, of course, came back to haunt the prime minister, I think, in many ways. So we can only hope that we do better, and as a host country, not alienate our single most important strategic partner right off the bat. It appears that, you know, Prime Minister Carney is not just getting along with the U.S. president, but there's this interesting constellation of leaders that is accumulating here. So if you look at, they all have a lot in common, right? So they used to work for investment banks, or were sort of in large sort of banking type business. They're people who have a lot of money. And they're people who have now come on to lead their countries. So think of Friedrich Merz, right, who's a multimillionaire, who worked for BlackRock, who also comes with this technocratic expertise, seems to have hit it off just fine with Donald Trump, not best friends, but it seems that Donald Trump respects him. Think of Emmanuel Macron, probably did techno-populist by definition, Mark Carney, and my sense is probably that Prime Minister Carney knows a bunch of people, maybe not Trump that well, but some of the people in his entourage. And so I actually think when these folks get together, they're likely going to get on reasonably well. Think of Keir Starmer, you know, he's another technocrat, right? A senior civil servant who becomes prime minister, not really on side ideologically, but, someone who can deal sort of in competence and expertise. And so It looks like all these people now have also President Trump on speed dial. And so I can actually see this being a rather interesting summit, both in terms of what happens in front of the cameras and what happens behind the cameras. And of course, following quickly on the heels of that is also, of course, 24, 25 June, the NATO summit in The Hague. So there's a lot of groundwork, a lot of opportunity for the Prime Minister to make up for Canada's past sins of commission and sins of omission that have left Canada so alone and so alienated in the world, if he plays his cards right and reasserts Canada as central to the world order that we're all looking to preserve.
And then the next time after G7 that Canada is under the world spotlight will be along with the United States and with Mexico. Canada and Mexico, of course, are junior partners with the U.S. for hosting the FIFA World Cup 26. The one-year countdown is June 11th. It's coming pretty quickly. And these aren't just sporting events. And this will be an extraordinary sporting event because it's the biggest single sport event in history, 48 nations across three countries in the last 39 days. It's going to be a big challenge to pull off, especially from a security standpoint, from three countries which in the past several months haven't exactly been the best of friends because of Donald Trump's trade war. What do you think we should look at towards this World Cup, and can these three countries pull it off and keep it secure and prevent the various security threats from manifesting? I mean, we're looking at a world that's a lot more dangerous than it was last time Canada was the host of a top-level sporting event. I'm speaking of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics.
It's an amazing opportunity. Look, we've never before had an entire continent, that is to say, the three countries together, host this type of a tournament. So it is an incredible opportunity to showcase North America, and for President Trump, who's not really one for soft power, it is a great opportunity to show how attractive and how interesting a place North America is after all the capital that he's spent in recent months. You know, I suspect Donald Trump is not a big soccer fan, if he's ever watched a soccer game, but Donald Trump is also somebody who loves the world stage. And I suspect that he will be front and center. And I think both sides here have an impetus to show that they can make their relationship work, in part because, of course, Donald Trump needs a prize. He needs to show others that it's worthwhile to negotiate with him and that you can get a deal, and that with that deal, you will be better off than you were before. I think so. Here's a really unique opportunity, I think, for the U.S. president, and I think he knows this, to sit down with Canada, sit down with Mexico, work out our differences so that he can show what he's been able to accomplish in North America and how everyone should emulate the way he's been able to make the great, beautiful game work in the great, beautiful continent. Probably something to that effect will be his words, would be my guess.
Well, thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. Professor Christian Luprecht, the Department of Political Science and Economics at Royal Military College and a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute, who has joined me from Brussels, Belgium, where he's on sabbatical.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Bob. Take care.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, new security vetting rules for civil servants take effect. Rules were drafted after recent alleged Chinese spying cases involving government workers, such as a former aide to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Premier, Vice Premier, Secretary General, and two Deputy Secretaries General of the Executive Yuan, will be among the first individuals subjected to the new vetting rules. Cohabitants of civil servants subjected to special vetting, as well as their cohabitants' parents, will also be vetted. In ABC News Australia, Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman by Australia's SailGP sailing team. The newly rebranded team is debuting at the Mubadala New York Sale Grand Prix this weekend. The stars of Deadpool and Wolverine have rebranded the team as Bonds Flying Ruse. Bonds is an underwear company in Australia. In Kyoto news, Japan begins debate on rice policy review as prices soar. While Japan no longer directly controls rice output, it still sets target production levels based on expected demand and offers subsidies to encourage farmers to grow other crops. In that environment, small fluctuations in rice harvests can lead to big swings in prices. The meeting came as rice released from government reserves began hitting store shelves at roughly half the recent average price of around $30 for 5 kilograms. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, the city over the past decade doubled extra paid time off awarded to exceptional non-union employees. The city's administrative rules for the leave make it clear it's supposed to be a reward based on merit. According to a public records request, non-union employees earned an average hourly wage of more than $68 or $131,000 in 2024. Simple math would suggest that additional paid time off granted last year totaled a little over $6 million, which is a threefold increase from $1.9 million in 2013. In 2024, almost 1,500 employees received management leave, an average of 60 additional hours apiece. That's up from 2013, when almost 800 employees received extra paid leave. In Cascadia Daily News, eviction filings in Washington skyrocket. Housing advocates hope a new law limiting rent hikes will help. Filings statewide reached an all-time high in 2024, having increased by 53% since 2019, and fiscal year 2025 is on pace to surpass those numbers. Additionally, Trump administration Medicaid cuts would impact more than 600,000 Washington residents. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Vancouver City Hall ordered to release more information about FIFA World Cup 26. And did Trump tariffs derail a partnership between FIFA World Cup 26 hosts Seattle and Vancouver? And BC Insurance Council bans and fines Socialite for falsely claiming York University MBA. Read the stories behind these headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand
alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to British Columbia's Filipino community, 174,000 people strong. June is Filipino Heritage Month in British Columbia. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 8th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 8th of June in 1992, World Oceans Day was celebrated for the first time? It was originally proposed by Canada's International Centre for Ocean Development and the Ocean Institute of Canada. Canada is, after all, surrounded on three sides by oceans, and it boasts a world record 243,000 kilometres of coastline. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. You can sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.